the moment the United States war in Iraq started going wrong, comparisons with the Vietnam War inevitably rose, with quagmire becoming a key buzzword. Yet is the current war in Iraq at all comparable to Vietnam? And if so, how? If not, in what ways is our current predicament different? And most importantly, what are we to do about it? Here to talk about his new book, Is Iraq Another Vietnam, is author Cale Balduck. And Cale, good morning. Welcome to KUCI.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for, A, for being here, and B, for writing this important book that I think has kind of been a topic on everyone's mind, but I'm not sure that people really wanted to, you know, explore whether we are involved in another Vietnam. Let's start by getting some background. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book, to ask this question.
Well, as a kid growing up in the 60s and 70s, I was aware that there was a war going on. People talked about it. I saw images on the TV news, images in Life magazine, because back then you had a lot better journalism and a lot more images of how things were over there coming back. As compared to today when it's so controlled by the military and the government. But anyway, that was kind of the war I grew up with. There were a number of young men that went to Vietnam from my small Midwestern town of 1,000 people, and some who came back with some psychological difficulties over that. And so just from that grounding, I just kind of held an interest in it and kept going back to it whenever topics would arise in the culture. And I'd read a book here or there until eventually I'd read quite a few books and then seen various documentaries and whatnot. So that was kind of just how it all germinated.
And at what point during the current war in Iraq did you decide, I got to write something? I mean, because it's one thing to ruminate and to compare. It's another thing to get the motivation to, actually do the research and write the book. And I must say, I really enjoy the footnotes. I think it's a well-documented book.
Thanks. I appreciate that. And I appreciate you having read the book closely. It's the whole mess we're in now. So many of us were against it from the beginning and thinking I just had a very bad feeling about it. This was a mistake. Lies were being told and all. And, the sort of angle that I obviously with this book focused on eventually last summer was after hearing a number of comparisons with Vietnam and then that rekindling my interest in reading a few more things on Vietnam and starting to look into some books on Iraq and the first Gulf War and the whole history leading up to this one. I just decided that as much as I knew about Vietnam and as little as I was hearing about Vietnam in any, good qualitative way, I wanted to go ahead and just delve into it myself and answer this question in as objective a manner as I could while still, putting forth my judgments about various things in both situations. So there wasn't really any perfect linchpin, I think, that made me do it. I started out gradually poking around here and there and eventually got to writing things, and it just sort of grew and grew and kind of wrote itself over a pretty intense several months.
Well, rather than answer the question, let's go from the beginning and take a look at the evidence. And I want to remind listeners, they're tuned to KUCI in Irvine, 88.9 FM, KUCI.org on the internet. This is Justice or Just Us. We're speaking with Cale Balduck. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Balduck.
Balduck. Looking at his new book, Is Iraq Another Vietnam? And let's begin talking about Vietnam. For some of the younger listeners who may not have, the kind of information that they do with the war in Iraq, explain the pretext for Vietnam.
Sure, and I would have to say that another reason that prompted me to write it is that the public in general, not just the younger people, just the public who even lived through the war and fought in the war, have a basic ignorance of the whole thing.
And if I could interject, I mean, sure. I think when we spoke on the phone, one of the things that I found so interesting about the book, I mean, I've been following the war in Iraq very, very closely, and not only through this radio show, but as you said, you know, through activism and paying attention to independent media. And it's so easy to read your book and uncover one of these quotes that you thought, gosh, I totally forgot about that. Yeah, I mean, we're bombarded with so much nonsense, whether it's news media or even, you know, what passes for news media, you know, the new Hollywood celebrity and the new American Idol and the new whatever. So,
and the new so-called journalism. I mean, this whole right-wing attack machine that's out there has really transformed this culture.
Exactly. So your point is well taken, that it's not only for Vietnam, but the current war. But that being said, what are some of the pretexts leading up to the war in Vietnam?
Well, I think it's important to understand that Vietnam went through a 1,000-year history of repelling invaders, mainly the Chinese, at various times, and then the French invaded and colonized it in the 19th century. The Japanese were there during World War II, and so Vietnam has this long history and cultural mythology of repelling invaders. I mean, they were the only culture to have repelled the Mongol hordes, and they did it twice. So it's a very tenacious culture and proud. And the Americans, they just saw as just the next step towards fighting invaders and independence and gaining independence. Some of the key things about U.S. involvement are that during the 50s, when the French refused to leave Vietnam and provoked the Vietnamese into a war of liberation, the Americans were getting heavily into the Cold War, and this was seen as simply a war against communism. At least that's the way the French got the U.S. so involved, was saying that if we don't stop these Reds here, they'll spread everywhere. And so the United States was paying for about 80% of France's war costs in the 50s. And even when France decided we've had enough and we want to get out, the United States says, no, you got to stay in there and at least have one more major battle. And that was the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, which was an utter disaster for the French, and they had to get out. Well, the sides came together at in Geneva and agreed to the Geneva Peace Accords to get the French out, and the sector of society that was fighting on the side of the French colonials and the side that was supporting Ho Chi Minh's forces, mostly, it wasn't just North Vietnam, the country wasn't even partitioned then, but they were concentrated in the north and coming out of there. Those sides still had tensions and could have carried on in a civil war, but these accords tried to make it so that we'll have a temporary division of the country in the middle. Those who want to go to the north and live under the communist regime do that. Those who want to go to the south and live under the United States puppet regime run by an autocrat down there, you could do that. Well, then there were supposed to be elections to take place in 1956, and whoever won the elections, that's whose regime it would be, the country would be unified under. What happened was that it became obvious that Ho Chi Minh in the north was going to win in a landslide. He would even have won in the south with 80% of the vote. And so the puppet president, Mr. Diem, in the south, the U.S. guy, he called off the elections. He went around the country, especially on the countryside, and trying to wipe out all the remnants of Ho Chi Minh's old army, which had not been militarily active per the Geneva Accords, they were allowed to politicize things and just, you know, be politically active but not engage in any kind of military activity. But and Ho Chi Minh even restrained them from fighting back for a few years, but in the end they couldn't stand just being massacred the way they were under the U.S.-supported president in the South. And so they had to fight back, and that's how what then grew into the Vietnam War that we know, really, that's where it had its roots. And American sent advisors to prop up the Diem regime. There was more military involvement of American personnel over there than was admitted. And so that was kind of the slow road into what we really got into after the Gulf of Tonkin incident and resolution.
Which I want to get into in a second, but I think, you know, to introduce the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, I think there needs to be just a little something said. You mention, of course, you know, the 1950s and the Cold War and the communism scare and this idea that if we don't get involved, you know, communism is going to spread. I don't know if that's what was referred to as the domino, you know, theory,
right,
of communism spreading. But, you know, was the public really that concerned about Vietnam and about communism in Vietnam spreading elsewhere? Or did the United States government, I guess in this case, you know, the Johnson administration, need some catalyst to spread fear within the American public?
Well, it didn't. Once the McCarthy era had come about and you really got people frightened in any case, just like today, Americans are very poorly informed about a lot of the things, and especially foreign affairs. So it was pretty easy just to do what we wanted in Vietnam during the 50s with practically no one in the United States paying attention until, I think mostly the Kennedy administration and their activities over there that heated things up and got people a little more aware. But even then, it wasn't – Americans didn't know much about it until – even during the war, actually. But
well, then what is, for our listeners, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution? We hear a lot about that today, actually, which is, you know, one of the comparisons that we often hear with Iraq. So if you could, you know, explain, if we had a presence in Vietnam up until the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, in what way was that a turning point?
Well, we had a pretty low-level presence. I mean, there were some maybe 15,000 quote-unquote advisors over there at that point. And this was after Kennedy had been assassinated and Johnson took over as president. In 1964, Johnson was in a presidential election, and he was having what he perceived to be a lot of pressure from the political right, and Barry Goldwater running against him, Goldwater having, you know, advocated nuclear weapons in Vietnam, if necessarily, to get rid of all the communists. And so Johnson was just playing politics here and wanting to look like he was a tough guy and wasn't going to wimp out on America's foreign policy. Just like these, the Bush administration were looking for some reason to hit Iraq and got it with 9/11 and everything. I'll talk about that later. Johnson got an opportunity in 64 when American ships were patrolling in the Gulf of Tonkin on the shore of North Vietnam, and they were spying, just collecting information, but they were also supporting South Vietnamese commando raids on various North Vietnamese installations. This, among other things, was in total disregard of the Geneva Accords, but in any case, the USS Maddox was patrolling in one day in 64, and the North Vietnamese just got tired of taking this lying down, and they sent a couple of patrol boats out there, and little skirmish instigated both sides firing, and it was over pretty quick. Well, this had made international headlines, and so President Johnson had to say something about it, and his public persona was, you know, this isn't too big a deal. We're not going to worry about it. We'll just let it pass and go on. But privately and secretly, he ordered that the USS Maddox go right back into the Gulf, go right back into the area where it was attacked, and the intention was obvious. He wanted it to be attacked, and so that he could have a pretext for going to war if necessary, for at least getting war powers. And his staff was drawing up papers even before the Maddox went back in. They were drawing up a resolution for Congress to give Johnson war powers. The Maddox went back in. The captain knew that the North Vietnamese were monitoring him. They were tracking him. He asked requests several times to get out of there, and the orders came down on high. No, you are to remain on course. Well, so the tensions and fears were obviously pretty high on the Maddox. And then at night, there came a storm over the Gulf. The crew was trying to follow the sonar and radar, but they were acting pretty erratically, and they didn't know how to interpret the blips on the screen, so they just started firing out of panic. They called in air support. The air support said, according to what they were seeing, there's nothing down there to shoot at. The next morning, the military did an investigation, and indeed, they didn't find any evidence that there had been enemy ships in range, and there had been no attack on the Maddox. But Johnson didn't like that answer, so that's not what President Johnson told the world. He, in fact, told the world that the United States had been unprovokedly attacked by the North Vietnamese communists. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was drawn up, sent to Congress. The House passed it unanimously, and in the Senate, only two senators voted against it. So Johnson got sweeping war powers if he needed them, which in the spring of 65, he did that, and he sent the Marines into Da Nang.
And so we see then that the plans to get involved in Vietnam were kind of there to begin with, and the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was the congressional authority, if you will, providing the Johnson administration with the justification for intentions they had to begin with. Is that a proper characterization?
I think that's pretty close. You could argue also that there was still some tentativeness there. There was no actual committal, but what Johnson wanted, if he needed it, was the power to wage war. And of course, he wanted to beat Barry Goldwater in the election, and so he wanted to at least appear like a hawk.
There you go. Okay.
But it definitely, I think, it created greater momentum toward what was maybe an inevitability.
Which brings us to a parallel of sorts with the Bush administration and Iraq. But we could even back up further, and without getting into too much detail, because we still have a lot to cover, but you write on page 15 of your book that, of course, if we look at a longer history of America's involvement in Iraq, it also began as an anti-communist crusade. Could you just briefly touch upon that?
Sure. It goes in Iraq back to at least into the 60s when the Ba'ath regime, which were basically fascists, came to power in coups, and the CIA, the only toggles in U.S. foreign policy back then was on-off switch for anti-communism. And so whichever forces came to power, as long as they were anti-communist, they would support them, and we did that in Iran in 53 when we overthrew the democratically elected president there and put in a dictator. That was mostly over oil, but then in 54 we overthrew the president of Guatemala and put in a regime of military dictators to uphold the interests of the United Fruit Company, but that was all done in the name of anti-communism too. So that Iraq was just part of the pattern, I think.
And then we come I want to remind listeners, we're talking to Cale Balduck, and we are talking about his new book, Is Iraq Another Vietnam? Right now, we're comparing, contrasting pretexts for intervention, if you will, in both geographic areas. We talked about Vietnam and the anti-communism crusade moving up to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which at least gave Johnson an opportunity, a political opportunity, whether he had reservations or not, is a point well taken. Looking now at Iraq, where, of course, our initial intervention in Iraq dating back to the 60s was also part of an anti-communism agenda, which brings us to the now famous Downing Street memo of July 2002. In what ways, if at all, is this Downing Street memo similar to events surrounding the Gulf of Tonkin? And if you could explain what the Downing Street memo is, though I'm sure most of the listeners of this program are probably by now familiar.
Yeah, the Downing Street memo is one of many memos now that have come about that have been leaked out of the British government. And that particular memo showed it was minutes of meetings between Bush and Blair fairly early on in 2002, more than a year before the war began. And they were basically agreeing that they had to attack Iraq, they had to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and that, you know, intelligence was going to be a problem. I mean, they had British intelligence coming over here and talking with our CIA people, and then they go back and report to Blair and his folks in the government there that, you know, the U.S. intelligence heads are on board here where things are being fixed. We're going to sex this document up. That one we're going to twist around. And that, you know, that occurred in the lead-up to the war, both in Britain and in the United States. What was the pretext, really? It was all about the weapons of mass destruction. That was going to be the policy was to invade Iraq. And the evidence was going to be doctored to fit around that policy. So,
and, of course, the Bush administration needed a congressional resolution to allow for an invasion in Iraq, which he then received with, I don't recall how many senators opposing, but, you know, one
not
is
many.
Not many. So my question to you is, in what ways are these pretexts similar? Do you see a parallel between the pretext for full-scale involvement in Vietnam and the pretext for full-scale involvement in Iraq?
I think that the pretexts for Iraq were much more cynical and self-serving on the part of our political and economic elite. They wanted to get control of Iraqi oil. They wanted to get Saddam Hussein out of the way because he had been our ally, and at the height of his viciousness and butchery, he was a perfectly good guy to the political elites in Washington. You know, good friend of Don Rumsfeld, as a matter of fact, who went over and met him a couple of times, made some deals with him. But that when he turned on us and became too independent, then it became a problem. And as we're heading into this coming oil crunch and the politics is being so fueled by big oil, all these things just kind of come together to generate a policy that pleases a lot of people, from the oil interests to the neoconservatives, who they have various agendas, and some of them will involve even issues like Israel, and a greater presence in the U.S. and the Middle East is a bulwark in defense of Israel and in some of these people's thinking. So it was much more premeditated, and the goals were set in Iraq, I think. it wasn't just a demonstration of U.S. power, although it certainly is. They had specific goals, and obviously the major portion of the planning for after the military conflict was to make a lot of wealthy corporations wealthier with all of this private contracting going, all this huge corporate welfare in the billions going to the Halliburtons and Bechtels and people like that.
Sure.
So this is, when it gets down to it, this is an experiment in creating an unnecessary war for the profit of relatively few.
We're speaking with Cale, it's Baldock, correct?
Baldock. Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could stay with us for the hour to continue speaking, or do you have to run?
No, I'm glad to stay.
Great. Well, then I'd like to just follow up on one last point. Sorry about that. I had to let someone in. I want to follow up on just one last point. You write in your book, actually, you quote Noam Chomsky during the Vietnam War, and he writes that the government, he's writing about Vietnam, the government does not really hope to convince anyone by its arguments and claims, but only to sow confusion, relying on the natural tendency to trust authority and to avoid complicated and disturbing issues. How can we be sure of the truth? The confused citizen turns to other pursuits. And gradually, as government lies are reiterated day after day, year after year, falsehood becomes truth. So the same kind of mechanism of creating obfuscation applied both during Vietnam and certainly applies today.
Yeah, definitely. You know, the planners of the Vietnam War, they certainly had their public facade, and they did things completely opposite in the back rooms. You know, they'd say, well, we're pursuing peace, and then they would, you know, bomb North Vietnam, and we're trying to protect the peasants from the communists, when what they were doing in the Pentagon Papers showed pretty clearly that they were attacking the peasants. I mean, American forces, air power, artillery, were attacking the peasants, and they're using various pretty evil intelligence mechanisms like the Phoenix program to go after people, spread fear, and drop napalm on people and burning entire villages down.
And, of course, today we have depleted uranium.
You got depleted uranium. White phosphorus has been used, apparently, in Iraq. Though, of course, the military denies it, but when I understand the Italians made a documentary about it and showed that it was used, and a number of American soldiers have come back from Iraq and testified that it had been used.
Well, let's move on to looking at the problems faced during the war. One of the things that I think was so surprising to so many Americans during Vietnam is how difficult the war was for American troops, for American forces. You've got, you know, the strongest, mightiest, wealthiest nation facing whether we want to call it an insurgency or guerrilla warfare, guerrilla strategy. You've got this small, poor country of Vietnam able to you know, really hold back American troops. Now we've got what are being called Iraqi insurgents, who certainly are causing, you know, you had Donald Rumsfeld thinking that we have the most technologically advanced army, military, and that we could fight this war overwhelmingly using technology. And what we're finding is that these strategies of old just don't work anymore. What are some of those similarities, or did I just cover them?
Well, there's probably more differences in that statement between the two conflicts. Let's see where to start. But the insurgency in Vietnam, the guerrillas there, they were very cohesive. They're all pretty much on the same page. They were well organized and were fighting a common enemy. the insurgency in Iraq has just come and gone in fits and starts and changed quite a bit over time. First of all, there were a lot of people just fighting the American invasion of all stripes, Sunnis, Shias, whomever. And then once the major fighting was over with and Saddam was gone, if there had been, as General Shinseki, the head of the army, had requested, several hundred thousand troops. I saw figures of 300,000 to 500,000 troops that were suggested by people like Shinseki, who had made a career in the military. Many of them had seen action in Vietnam. They went to the U.S. Army War College and studied these things, and they were just completely trampled by this arrogant, incompetent fool, Donald Rumsfeld, who, by the way, I called on him and Wolfowitz to resign in letters to the editor over a year ago. But the ongoing insurgency now is really just unlike the Vietnamese. It's scattered. The insurgents are fighting one another as much as anything. The country's just in tatters and ruins socially and otherwise in its infrastructure. And that's probably just mostly the fault of Rumsfeld and the neocons around him who came out of a certain philosophy of things. A lot of this goes back quite a few years to different military strategy and intelligence recommendations. When Rumsfeld gets an idea in his head, I think the man is just so egomaniacal that it's incredible that so much of this ongoing misery on all sides can be laid at his feet. And I don't know whether you want me to go into more about any specific thing there.
No, I think you touched upon it quite nicely. There's certainly more. There was certainly more cohesion in Vietnam than there is now. That being said, we're stuck in what I think can only be called a quagmire. You've got an interesting take on what should be done now. What should be done now? And explain yourself if you can.
Well, I know that I'm going to find myself at odds with most of the anti-war movement, most of the political left on this. But I think that the mistake people make in one of the mistakes they make in comparing Iraq to Vietnam too closely is that, of course, the situation in Vietnam should have been left alone and should have been tried to be settled through negotiations between the parties there, the Vietnamese, before the United States went in there and just blew the country apart. But, and of course, the war should not have been fought. But the problem in Iraq, I'm afraid, is that whereas the U.S. should have gotten out of Vietnam as quickly, once it did get in as quickly as the anti-war movement was calling for, then I think we're kind of misreading the situation today if we're calling, especially those for calling for an immediate withdrawal. Now, people are calling for different degrees of withdrawal and under different conditions. And I agree that, we've got to get out of there eventually, but especially an immediate withdrawal, I think that as bad as things just keep getting among the various factions there and the threat of civil war happening, there's just too many indications that an already bad situation would become just horrifically worse, and the torture and killing and just chaos, fear that's a daily reality there would multiply many times. Plus, there's a lot of potential for this to spread, I think, either to the immediate neighbors or if Al-Qaeda especially gets a lot more involved in Iraq as it starts to devolve into chaos. There are other Al-Qaeda factions or just other radical Islamic factions in various surrounding countries in the Middle East there that would likely be invigorated and inspired by that and would, just like they've tried to blow up the Saudi, big Saudi refinery recently, and they've tried about six times to kill President Musharraf in Pakistan. If either one of those scenarios came to be, I mean, the Saudi oil supply went down the tubes, the world economy might just creak to a halt. And if Islamic fundamentalists got a hold of the government of Pakistan, they'd also have their nuclear weapons. And what's India going to do next door once, if a radical fundamentalist regime comes to power in Pakistan? Or the whole idea of preemption has been displayed by the United States as something that, you know, other countries are going to say it's legitimate for us to do it. And then other commentators pointed out that this insurgency might turn into a global insurgency. So I think we just have to be at least measured in what we're calling for here and look at the reality on the ground and what's going to be best for the people of Iraq and the Middle East in general.
So what do you propose?
I think that, as I said in the book, I called for more international participation in this and getting Iraq's neighbors involved in some negotiations.
How is that going to happen, though?
How is that going to happen? I mean, I don't know but the nuts and bolts of how you run negotiations like that.
How do you convince... Let me begin by agreeing with you that one of the things that I've had a problem with, because I am calling for a quote-unquote immediate withdrawal, but I don't refer to that as cutting and running or as just, you know, overnight getting every single troop out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's largely people from the political right who refer to bringing the troops home as cutting and running or the immediate 100% complete withdrawal. I mean, that's like, you know, just pulling the rug right out from under people. So I would agree with you that it's important, even with people on the left, to be sure to properly characterize what they mean. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you give fodder for the other side.
That's important because if we pull out and a disaster happens, the spin doctors are masterful enough to blame this all on us.
Exactly. And I think that's a point well taken. However, I find it problematic, and with all due respect to you, referring to the potential for a civil war. I mean, I think we're about as close to what we could call a civil war as we're ever going to get. And more importantly, maybe I'm one of these cynical individuals, but I'm not so sure that it wasn't the intention of the neocons to spark a civil war to begin with.
I heard an interesting take. I read an interesting take by Greg Palast recently that they said that, well, the Bush administration and the oil people got exactly what they wanted in all this chaos because Iraq cannot pump oil, and that keeps supplies low and the price high. Maybe that's related. I'm not sure quite what's the neocon take on the Civil War.
The numbers, I'm trying to find them online, but certainly the month of March was one of the deadliest months, both for U.S. troops and, more importantly, civilians in Iraq. So the numbers are getting worse. They're not getting better.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that justify our continued presence as an attempt to bring about stability?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
And I'm not attacking you, because
no,
I understand
it's
that...
my question.
Exactly.
And I see where you're coming from. I just think that, if you have... some kind of a stabilizing force there in terms of police, military, and whatnot, I think that's keeping some kind of lid on it. Yeah, it's bad, and it seems to gradually be getting worse, but if you take that away and there becomes a security vacuum, I just see things not getting any better by taking that away. And there, people have got to step up to the plate, I guess, is the answer to how we go about getting countries involved in trying to get insurgents involved in negotiations and all. And it may be past the point where we can do that. I think you're right. Things are worse now than they were even last summer when I was writing the book. But I just see that as the most promising way, trying to negotiate, looking toward even a ceasefire and an amnesty. I've seen a few other people writing about this, calling for similar things, that if that's at all possible, to get people at least talking about a ceasefire and amnesty, but also with announcing that, you know, the U.S.'s intention to leave. I think if those can all be done in tandem, then the pressure points would hopefully be taken off of the conflict. The people who are fighting, who are angry because of the occupation presence, would hopefully be somewhat mollified by that. And those with the factional sectarian interests would hopefully see some kind of end, feasible end in sight to what they're angry over. And it's, but you know, you're right in that people just, they don't seem to be doing that. You know, I think the rest of the world is kind of keeping its distance from this.
Sure.
and letting the U.S. deal with its quagmire.
Well, and I've got, we're very rapidly running out of time, right. And I want to give you an opportunity to tell listeners how to get a hold of the book, but I've got two last questions that I hope you could answer very shortly. First of all, answer your question, is Iraq another Vietnam?
Well, of course, it's yes and no. No two wars are the same. We're not in danger of losing tens of thousands of people as it goes. We lost nearly 60,000 soldiers, 300,000 were wounded. So in that sense, I don't think we're slaughtering near as many people over in Iraq as we were in Vietnam. But the potential for the negative fallout of this war is much worse than Vietnam, I think.
Okay. And I think that's a great answer. And then finally, you know, we're here in, I'm here in Orange County, California, you know, one of the hearts of conservative politics. It might be the state of California, but it's certainly a conservative county. You're in Kansas City, Missouri. Could you just tell us briefly, what's it been like to be a critic of the war and a critic of, I'm guessing, but that you're probably also a critic of some of the other policies of the current administration. How has that been?
Well, it's tough to have much of a dialogue with people in this town in terms of opposition to the war. And it's changing, I think. People are getting tired of this, and just general public opinion is reflected as much in Kansas City as it is overall. When the majority of people now are against staying in Iraq, and they think this is wrong, that's reflected in even conservative Midwest. But at the same time, you know, your anti-war rallies and all, they might draw 1,000 people most recently, but there were just, you know, handfuls of folks out there in the early days, maybe a dozen, very courageously opposing this when you had huge hordes of pro-war people counter-demonstrating too. So,
well, I want to thank you for being a critic and for writing this book. And could you tell our listeners how to get a hold of your book? It's titled "Is Iraq Another Vietnam?"
Well, in Orange County, did you get those books I sent you, Jarrett?
I have not yet received them.
Okay, they should be coming, hopefully. I sent some to 2,000-plus books in Long Beach, and I don't know whether they decided to carry them or not. If otherwise, you can go to isiraqanothervietnam.com. Just don't put the question mark in there, and I've got them for sale online.
Great, and hopefully the books will arrive to me, and listeners can call in to the program during our fun drive next week and maybe we will have some of the books available as a premium. So
yeah, please use them as you will. That's great.
Great. Well, Cale Baldock.
Right.
There you go. This has been great. I'm sure I'll be speaking with you again, and we'll have to have you back on the program. But thank you so much for spending the hour with us this morning for this really important discussion. It's a really great book, a really quick read, and I mean that in the best, most positive sense. So thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Well, thank you, Jared. I appreciate it.
Take care.